Alonzo Bowden. I want to welcome you to my podcast, Who's Paying Attention? And this week, we're going to do something a little different. I told you guys that I spent the summer on KBLA Radio, and one of the things I enjoyed about it were the interviews. The interviews were great, but unfortunately, doing a radio interview, you got to stop at 6 minutes for the first commercial break, and then at 15 for the other, then news and traffic at the top and bottom, all of that, and it just broke up the flow of the interview. So now I am lucky enough to have as my guest my old friend, brilliant comic, great writer. You might know him as Crazy Legs from Don't Be a Menace to Society. You may have seen his comedy documentary, Dying Laughing. He wrote a brilliant article for The Hollywood Reporter about Gary Shandling, and I'm going to talk to him about that because I didn't know they were playing ball in his backyard. I never got invited to those games. So without further ado, my old friend, Sully McCullough. What is up, brother?
What's up, man? It's good to see you.
It's great to see you. And there's so much I want to talk to you about. You know, I will tell you, audience, this is Sully might not even remember how far we go back because he's been in the game a little longer than me. And back in 93, I was a doorman at the Laugh Factory. It was my first job in comedy, you know, hoping to get on stage. I would hope that people wouldn't show up so I could get on stage. And this was when you used to roll with the Wayans and
yes.
Chris Spencer and
yes.
Alex Thomas. They would come in, there would be two, I think, was it Range Rovers with a car at the time? Whatever
that was their car.
Yeah.
They had, but Sean and Marlon both had matching
and they
Range
just,
Rovers.
They just kept coming out.
Yes.
There would just be a
yes.
comics. Just
yes.
keep two Range Rovers
yes.
would pull up and like 15 comics just
yes.
came out.
Yeah. That was a good time. That was like back around the Don't Be a Menace time. But we all sort of started at the Laugh Factory around that time. So we naturally became friends, and I think it was a good thing to have at that time. You know what I mean? Like, we really motivated each other and pushed each other, and, you know, the Wayans, Sean and Marlon had Keenan and Damon, so we were in really good company. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Well, that's something that you have maintained over the years, the network, I should say, of comedy. Back then, obviously, it was a lot of support, but now, and I'm going to be jumping back and forth, but let's jump forward to now where you have become the joke writer for like every time a black comic hosts something. What they say on that, the Oscars, it's like get Bruce. Like every brother
yeah.
is
well,
get Sully. Jamie
Foxx,
Cedric,
whoever. You know what's funny, though? I would
Cedric,
say, I, would say I don't claim that. I think Chris Spencer claims that, and he is the even broader version of it. I'm kind of the if we've had a long-standing relationship and we've worked together, you know, the door's always open.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting, though. Like, the writing stuff happened for me as the Jamie Foxx show was ending. Like, I was an actor on the Jamie Foxx show. We would do a scripted pass, and then we would do a wild pass where anything goes. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
which improv.
It was improv.
Just, right.
But it has to be improv grounded in structure. And so I remember we would do scenes on the Jamie Foxx show, and Garrett Morris was on the show. And he would be like, before we would do the wild take, he'd be like, man, I don't know what to say. And I would pitch him stuff. And he'd be like, that's good, right? And he
yeah.
tried and it worked. And so I feel like Garrett Morris was one of the first people that acknowledged that I had that skill set. And, you know, I was writing and producing in those moments before I was actually paid to do it.
Right.
But,
so you were doing it before you knew you were doing it.
Absolutely. And he was, you know, I mean, I had so much respect for him with, you know, his lineage with SNL. And, you know, if he liked it and it worked for him and I was pitching stuff in his voice, that was a sign that I was doing something right.
So now, and again, chronologically, I'm jumping back and forth, but this is because you recently, you wrote for Cedric for the Emmys.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
In this time, okay, in the atmosphere we're in, it sounds to me like that is a minefield, right? To walk into the Emmys, you have Hollywood, which is always trying to, we want to push the envelope, but we don't want to offend anybody. And we can't talk about this, and we don't want to say that. We want you to write jokes, but who comes to you, or does anyone come to you with parameters? Is it the show? Is it the network? Is it the host? Who says, Sully, we want you to be funny, but...
That's a great question, because a lot of times people don't even think that award shows have writers. You know what I mean? They just think that it just magically happens. And, you know, everyone's just speaking off the cuff and it just, you know, it just happens. But for this situation, for the Emmys in particular, Cedric gave me a call and said, hey, I'm hosting the Emmys, you know, and I'd like you to write for me. And then he said, can you do it? Like, are you free? Can you do it? I was like, yeah, I can do it. Yeah. And yes. And yes.
You mean while you were sitting around on a Zoom meeting during the pandemic, you found time to write for the Emmys?
Yes. So it was like the ask was funny to me because it was such like, of course I'll write on the Emmys for you. So, you know, it's cool. Like I wrote for Cedric on a few things prior to the Emmys. I took a producing credit on one of his early specials. I wrote for him on the American Music Awards. I wrote for him on the Correspondents' Dinner. So I know Cedric's voice. I know his style. And it's a great opportunity to put a comedic stamp on something that's a gigantic show. I mean, that show is a... It's the Emmys.
Yeah, like, you know what I mean? It's huge. It's huge. Now, when you do that, do you have to see everything that's nominated so that you're ready for it?
Well, here's the thing is when he asked me, at that point, I was like, okay, I've got to do a deep dive on what people are talking about, what's making an impact, what are the nominated shows, just so my comedy is drawing from what's being honored. You know what I mean? It's like that's where most of the jokes are going to come from. They're going to come from, you know, the things that have all the nominations. And I honestly am in a space right now where I'm not watching a ton of TV. So I had to deep dive, you know, and really figure out what the big, you know, things in TV are. I watched The Crown. I watched Ted Lasso. I watched, you know, WandaVision. I watched, you know, all the things that...
Yeah, that they're talking about.
Yes, that they're talking about. And even like the comedy specials that were nominated, the ones that I wasn't familiar with, I watched. And, you know, you're also mining for ideas. You're like, if these are the things that... this award show is honoring and that has the potential to represent the best of TV, your jokes, your bits, you know, your ideas, the monologue, it has to reflect that.
So now you're doing this, and again, the writing, the discipline in the writing fascinates me because as a stand-up, and you're a great stand-up, but you know, when we do stand-up, it's like, what's funny to me?
Yes, yes.
I can write about
anything. You start
anything.
From a very
I
core
can,
place.
Like, something funny to me, I'm going to start writing about
yes,
it. I'm going to do a
yes.
bit. But now you have to, like, okay, Sully, make The Crown funny.
Yes, yes.
Which isn't.
Yes. And what's also difficult about it is... the Emmys is such a broad mainstream show, you have to touch the people that may or may not pay attention to The Crown. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
they're going to be like, yo, I'm out anyway. You know what I mean? So whatever your Crown idea is, it has to touch the regular person.
Now, and again, I'm asking this as a stand-up.
Okay.
Okay, and we got Sully stand-up and Sully writer.
Yes.
Isn't it frustrating to have to do that, to have to vanilla your take for mainstream people who, like you said, they don't know The Crown or they're watching the Emmys, you know, and like they say, you're in your living room after dinner –
Yeah.
So you can't come with some hard edge take, right? Or can you? I don't know.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, dude, because there were things that appealed to me as a person, like the Lovecraft Country was nominated for 18 nominations.
Right.
But it was also canceled after the first season. So, you know, that's...
Because they're still trying to figure out what just happened.
Exactly.
You like watch it, Lovecraft, yes. You're like, yes. What did I just watch?
Yes. And the monsters that you see on screen have nothing to do with the racial monsters that the show right. is really tackling. So that's fascinating to me mm-hmm. and my perspective. But to relate that to a general audience that may be like, I never watched it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's really the difficulty that you have to manage. And when writing monologue jokes, you've got to address the fact that this show has all these nominations. It was canceled in the first, but where's your target? Who's your attack point? Yeah. Are you attacking the executives? Are you attacking the fact that, yeah, we can praise something, but at the end of the day, it's over and done. So it's self-congratulatory, but it doesn't build a legacy.
Right.
So that's a deeper idea. And you have a 3-minute monologue. So, so you definitely have to pick and choose what your targets are.
Right. And I love this. I love this for the audience because you guys hear the jokes.
Yes.
And you don't. And I know just from experience and knowing you, these are the thoughts. It's great you can put it into words because it's not like you sit down and do like you have a shorthand in your head.
Yes.
To get
yes.
from, you know, point A to point C.
Yes.
But, well, point A to point E. But
yes, yes.
B, C, and D, this is what's going on, and these are the thoughts.
Well, I'll tell you this. Like, I had come up with this idea that I was really excited about that I thought would be great in sketch form. And it was a parody of WandaVision, but with Wanda Sykes.
Wanda Sykes.
Which was, you know, when I was like, oh, that's hilarious. You know what
and,
I mean? Like,
and just on a side note, how is Wanda Sykes not on that show telling Wanda what to do? Because Wanda Sykes
right,
is always telling
right.
a white woman what to do. She's a white woman's best friend.
You see where the comedy is already. You see it's inherently funny. So we could have executed it that way. The script that I wrote was Wanda Sykes as the lead character and Cedric as Vision and the two of them interacting going through time in these different genres of TV, but it's like the Sanford and Son era. And you know what I mean? Like, so
right.
to me, it was like, let's completely turn this on its ear and take something that is, you know, that show had, I believe, 22 or 24 nominations this mm-hmm. year. So it's a hugely nominated show that you've got to find the funny and find the funny in a way where it best services your host. So that was something that never saw the light of day. It was mentioned in the monologue as a punchline, but that's one of those things that I wrote that I was excited about where we could really turn it on its ear that never came to be, you know?
How attached are you to those things when you create an idea like that? Because, again, this is the frustration of the writer's room that you have this great idea and somebody's like, no, we're not going to do it. How attached are you and how has that changed over the years because you've been doing this?
Well,
you've been doing this for a minute now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, with the Emmys, you know, I mean, as a comic, the only thing that you can really be responsible for is initially trusting your instincts with a comedic idea and using that to move it as far along as you can. There are always going to be people above you that are looking at the budgets of what you're writing, the accessibility of what you're writing. Can they feasibly pull this off in a way? And if it dies because of those reasons, you can't really be too married to anything. Like, that's one of the things that I learned. I spent a year as a writer at The Tonight Show.
Right.
And that was the year that they were phasing Jay out to bring Conan in. And as a monologue writer, I came in because an executive at NBC, Obama had just got the nomination, and they looked at the landscape of what their shows were and said, hey, we're about to have the first black president. We should probably have a writer on staff.
We should probably have the first black writer.
I wasn't the first.
No, I know.
I was
know.
The third, but that was the line of thinking, is yeah. we should probably have a writer that's reflective of who's about to assume the role of president. So they had a diversity department. This was in 2008. They had a diversity department. There were no black writers in the diversity department. And Jack Cohen, who was mm-hmm. a writer on staff at the
Jack.
Time,
yeah.
Said, hey, I know somebody that I think would be good for this. So I had to write a page of monologue jokes and had a meeting. The jokes were good enough that I got hired. And I spent a year as a monologue writer on The Tonight Show. And of the makeup of that show, it was 18 writers total, 15 white guys, 2 women, and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very interesting year. As you remember, when Obama took office, you know, it was an exciting time. It was a time where...
It was earth-shattering.
Yeah, it was like...
You
would... Remember on stage, you would mention his name and people would break into applause breaks?
Right, right.
Like, just the mention yeah. of Barack Obama's name.
He was a rock star.
Yes.
He was not even the rock star at
yes.
the time.
And yeah. so that was an exciting time for me as a writer, because I felt like, okay, cool, I'm... writing on The Tonight Show, this is rarefied air. This is A-list late-night television. But that's where I learned you're writing for Middle America and you're writing monologue jokes for Jay Leno. So if he can't grasp it and his audience can't grasp it, then you're just – it's a shot in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
So just to connect back to what you're saying about the parameters of comedy and having it have to – make sense to Middle America, that's where I first learned that on a day-to-day basis.
And that leads me to my next question, the art versus the business. Because people see the art, they see the creativity, but they don't see the business side. Like you said, the guy who says, yeah, that sketch might be funny, but it costs too much to make.
Right.
Or, you know, we can't do that. Like, I remember when I was doing Last Comic, they had a talk with us, and they were like, we're not going to censor you. You can say anything you want except brand names,
mm-hmm.
right? They don't want brand mm-hmm. names because mm-hmm. they don't want to upset an advertiser.
Sure.
And comics have gone down in flames over this fight, but you're smart enough, mature enough to understand art versus business. So talk a little about that.
Well, I think that that's just come from the experiences of being on both sides of the camera. You know what I mean? Like, As a talent, you're more autonomous, right? You basically are like, look, this is what I'm bringing with me. These are my jokes. This is my character. This is whatever. When you're on the other side, you're just trying to meet objectives, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and I've learned that, you know, I started out doing extra work. You know what I mean? So I've seen the business from many different vantage points. And coming in as a writer, producer, and a creative, you got to execute,
yeah.
if that makes sense. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I mean, I've been very lucky, because working with the different talent, like from the Jamie Foxx show, when that show ended, Jamie started hosting a lot of shows. He hosted the ESPY Awards. He hosted the MTV Awards. And I started writing for him mm-hmm. at that time. Like, after the Jamie Foxx show, people were like, you know, you're such a funny actor. What happened to you? It was like, well, I started writing and producing for Jamie Foxx, and I didn't stop.
And that's a good job.
And I didn't stop working after that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it was like it naturally slid into its own lane.
Now, let's talk about outrage and outrageous. Because,
okay.
you know, you talked about Barack Obama mm-hmm. and the Barack Obama era. And as a comic, people ask, what was it like with Barack Obama? I said, it was tough to be funny with Barack Obama because, A, he was perfect, and B, he was so funny himself.
Yes,
and that,
yes.
The joke kind of became like, is there anything wrong with this guy? You know,
and that was a tough thing about writing on The Tonight Show, too, because you know, while I was brought in to be a more authentic perspective, they were looking at me like, okay, what can we make fun of?
Right.
You know what I mean? And you're the guy that's going to give them that perspective, which it's a little unfair to put that on one person.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But that's the nature of corporate comedy.
It's I had to speak for all black people last week.
Yes,
every now and then you're asked to speak for all black people.
Yes,
it's part of the job.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So we went from Barack Obama to you go to the Trump era.
Yes.
Where the whole thing is outrage. What crazy, outrageous statement can he make? And not just him, but, you know, social media and also the fact that I know your kids – like, we know social media, but your kids grew up with social media.
Right.
They're tied in, and maybe that ties you in more. We're in an era now where it's all about what outrageous – doesn't have to be based in truth. Truth is that train left a long time ago.
Truth is eight-track player. It's an eight-track.
So in this era of the outrageous statement and the, you know, controversial blah, 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 you're working as a writer. Do you try to do that? Do you try and in your comedy? And I'll ask you this in both hats, in your stand up and in your writing for other comics and other shows, do you try to go with this outrageousness that, you know, they say, well, it gets the most clicks. Like, that's what they're shooting for.
Yeah. I mean, that was something that was discussed within the Emmy thing where it was like, we need something to go viral. And that's always interesting when people say that, because then that means you're sort of forcing the hand. You know what I mean? You're trying to create outrageousness, which is exactly what you're talking about, as opposed to it happening organically. Like, for me, my instinct is you can't set up those moments.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you have to trust.
They know it's false.
Yeah, exactly. It reads false. Like, that's one great thing about stand-up is stand-up gives you – it's truth serum times 100. You know what I mean? Like, they smell fakeness even if they don't know that they don't like that smell. They still smell it, you know? Whenever I hear those directives, I ignore them. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like, oh, this is just somebody that is trying to justify their job, that is approaching comedy from a fear-based place, and I'm not hearing that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's so you only have infinite amount of space what you're going to focus on. You know what I mean? Like, control what you can control, and to me, you know, I'd rather put my energy towards something I actually believe in.
Yeah. See, I hate to do this, right? Because I'm tired of answering the questions, so I hate to bring it up to you. But we can't not talk about it. And obviously, I'm talking about Dave Chappelle and The Closer.
Yes.
And in regards to what you're talking about, I'll give my take in that, and I want to see what you think. Dave he's not trying to be outrageous or create all of this. He's telling his truth. He's doing his stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of these people start trying to take it apart. And it's people who aren't comics, by the way.
Absolutely.
People who have no idea what
absolutely
the brilliance
they
of
don't
what
know
he,
what
in
the,
my opinion,
they
the
don't
brilliance
know what the craft
what
is. They don't know what your objective on stage is. It's like you're not championing thing that, you know, like when you get on stage, there has to be a reason for you to be on stage. And I don't want to get lost in this strange debate, because when I watched Dave's special, I felt like there were issues that were raised that were worthy to be discussed that still have yet to be discussed. I think one of the big points that he made about one marginalized group completely leapfrogging another one and having their parameters of boundaries so tightly defined that you can't even hurt their feelings versus what you can do to a black man in America.
Right.
And I thought that point still has yet to be discussed in a nuanced way, because it's such a important point in understanding marginalized groups.
I read a thing and they said it was like a choice of, is Dave attacking the transgender community, you know, LGBTQ community, or is he attacking the white community, you know, from a point of view of what you said, where you're looking at, okay, this one group, they have the option of being white.
Yes.
You know, it's so, yes. And I said, in my opinion, yeah, he's attacking white people the same way he has for the past 20, 30 years. Like, it's still, that's still the oppressor he's looking at. That's still the discrimination he's looking at. And as you said, when one group, when one marginalized group is so tight that they you can't attack them, which isn't true, by the way, but you can't say anything about them. But when they're truly offended, they basically go white.
Right.
And
right.
That was, and that's what he was, that's one of the things he was pointing out.
Right.
You know, when, spoiler alert, people, if you haven't seen it by now, I don't know. But when he talked about getting into it with the gay guy.
Yeah.
When the gay guy calls the cops, he's not a gay guy. He's a white man being attacked by a black
asserting
man.
Asserting his right to have this situation correct.
And that is, it, and that's why.
But that's a level of understanding racial dynamics,
yeah,
and how America works that I think mainstream America is so far away from being ready to hear because it's almost too real.
Well, it is, and that's Dave's greatness, right?
Yes.
To tap,
yes,
into that.
Yes.
Now, so,
and I will say this, like, as a producer, when I watched the special, I was like, oh, he should have probably did 10 or 15 minutes about his family and what's going on with him.
Right.
So when you assess it all, you go, okay, he told us about him. He told us about his issues. He told, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, when you break down the pie chart of, mm-hmm, how much time you put into certain subjects, you get a fuller picture of who you are, where you're coming from in this moment. Even though Dave is wildly popular and a household name and considered the GOAT by many, you still got to let people know what's going on in your life in this space and time too.
Yeah. Well, I think he did at the end. I think when he talked about his personal relationship with someone in,
yes,
the trans community,
yes, yeah,
that he talked about that. But now I'm going to – so now we're looking at Dave and what Dave did, right? But then I always compare him to Carlin, right? Because,
right,
they're not just comics. They're social commentators.
Sure.
Okay. And in,
sure,
my opinion – Dave has taken the title from Carlin as the greatest social commentator there is. I think he did that with 846. It was,
mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm,
so brilliant. But what people, you know, nobody's talking like Carlin did a suicide special. Like
right,
would they lose their minds? They're like,
right,
yeah, George Carlin was like, you know, suicide ain't bad for some people. You know?
I still feel like.
Would that be like, would they attack Carlin now and say he's bullying suicidal people? And it, no, I know it,
dude,
sounds
you
ridiculous,
never,
but you never
know where the attacks are going to come from.
Right.
You know what I mean? And oftentimes the attacks are linked to, this is our agenda and this is our moment to push forth our agenda.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that. Comedy really is, you know, I think it's weird that we're in a space where we're debating whether Dave's special is funny or not, or is it controversy, or you know what I mean? Like, this,
yeah,
dude,
see,
is a master stand-up.
And this is why I didn't want to go into this, because I'm not debating any of that.
I get it.
Yeah, you get it. But my point is the people who are talking about this and all, it's like, well, then don't watch it. Because you can't tell him, like,
or I would say watch it, because most of the people,
well,
arguing,
watch it to the end.
Well, most of the people are arguing about it. They haven't seen it.
That's true. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And the people who are saying he can't say this, to them, I always say, okay, what happens when you say something and someone decides you can't say that?
Sure.
You know, it's like, no, he can say it. And all of this, when, you know, we get back to the subject of outrage and false outrage, it's like, okay, well, you're okay with outrage over something ridiculous. Like, Nicki Minaj talking about, you know, vaccines. I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to Nicki for medical advice.
Right.
I love Nicki Minaj.
Right.
But if I got a medical question, Nicki's not at the top of my list.
She's not the person that you're going to.
But it's fun to have all this smoke about that, right?
Sure.
Because it means nothing.
Sure.
But when you go after Dave, Dave doesn't apologize. And like you said, if you watch the body of work, the body of work means something. He says something.
Mm-hmm.
So is this culture false? This outrage, this whatever, is it just another? Because another thing, you know, Netflix is lit. They're laughing all the way to
they're
the
bank. Loving it. They're loving it.
You couldn't
they're
get this much free
it because
publicity.
It's controversy that leads to profits. Like, the reason, you know, if they would have took it off the air, they knew for a fact people would have been like, I'm canceling my subscription.
Oh, absolutely.
And all that matters that, you know, I mean, we're in the comedy business. All that matters is, can you draw?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And that's their thing,
can
right?
Can you draw?
They don't talk about it, but the thing with Netflix is what? Like, if someone watches 3 minutes of it, that's a win.
Yes.
You better believe.
Yes.
You know, like if Dave said, okay, I'll do another one, it's going to cost $1 billion. Netflix
they're
gonna
pay
be like,
it.
We got a billion. We got a billion, don't we?
Yep. We'll pay it. We can find the money.
Have you, I'm going back to you as the comic.
Okay.
Have you had any experience like that where you did or said something and it was pulled or you were admonished or fired or anything like that for a joke or activity?
Yeah, of course.
Would you care to elaborate? Have we passed the statute of limitations?
I don't know if we have, but it's something that, you know, it's that stuff happens all the time. It mm-hmm. happens all the time. And I think about even jokes that I wrote earlier in my career that I can't do now.
Oh, absolutely.
Because
Give me one.
And this is, I'm going to preface it by saying I don't do it now.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I'll explain the funny to the people. Just,
right.
The funny is that I would never do this. I used to do this joke where I said, this girl accused me of not being aggressive enough with her, which is weird because I was raping her at the time. And the punchline is,
you're dead.
I'm 118 pounds soaking wet. Like, and she's saying you're not being aggressive enough.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a completely fabricated, harmless joke. And the funny was, he said something unexpected.
Right.
And, you know, he's calling out that being a nice guy, you're not aggressive with women. You know, are they perceived that as not being aggressive? But anyway, that was a joke that I used to do that I could never do now.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you ever did Dom Herrera's show at the Factory. He used to do a show about that where you had to come down and do a joke you couldn't do anymore, and then talk about it. Because I had one. That, you know, I'm looking for a special kind of woman. It's hard to find them. I'm looking for a woman who could take a punch.
Yeah, I remember that joke.
and the thing about that joke, where that joke came from, was I was dating a kickboxer.
Yes.
And that's where that joke came from because the joke was like, I would ask, like, so can you kick my ass? I'm just curious if you could.
Yeah.
Like, if you, you know, and it was funny and it was okay. And this was in the, you know, late 90s where you could do a joke like that. I'm not doing that joke today.
I used to do a joke, dude, where I would talk about my circle of friends where girls would want to sleep with them and befriend me.
Yeah.
And they would treat me like I was their gay friend, Raul. Right? And it was like, Raul's a hilarious gay name. Even if you don't know Raul, he's a picture is painted. But I don't even think I could do that joke now because somebody would be like, oh, you're making fun of gay people. It's like, no, that's not the...
But, and I'm going to just tell you how I feel about that with a joke like that.
Right.
They're just going to have to be mad. That small percent, because that's a very funny bit, right?
Yeah, so, in other words, it speaks to the truth of how women would interact. They would be like, I want to get with that guy. I want to get with that guy. I want to stay friends with you.
Yeah. And, you know, if in a 200-seat room... The five people who were offended by that joke, and I guarantee you, gay guys would be laughing their ass off. There'd
of course.
Be a gay guy named Raul who would think it's the funniest
hilarious.
Thing you ever heard.
Yeah.
But the five people who would be offended, they're just going to have to be mad.
Right.
I mean, that's part of comedy, right?
And
when we say that, and I'm talking to the audience now, when we say that, that's not a cop-out, and we're not trying to make it okay for us to be unfeeling, rude, stupid, or attack. But there is a part of comedy that, yes, someone's feelings are going
to
get
Dude,
hurt.
Your act has to have a bite to it.
You
and
would
if
hope.
It doesn't, you are a you're a balloon. You know what I mean? You're a Mylar balloon. And that's cool at a party. That's not good on stage. You better have some – we call them punchlines for a reason.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I personally, whenever someone explains someone as a really nice guy, as a comedian, that's borderline an insult.
Well, that's the giveaway. The giveaway.
You're like, oh, they're not funny.
Is he funny?
Yeah,
man,
they're not funny.
He's a really nice
guy. He's a really nice guy. You know what I mean?
That's like, the last thing. You want that to come out after funny.
After funny. Like, he's hilarious and he's a nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to open with, man, you know, she's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's nice.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, ooh.
Yeah, that's, yes.
No,
yeah.
give me
yeah, I need some more.
So,
I'll tell you this, dude. Like, I wrote a sketch on the Emmys that the premise of it was, you know, with everything that we've gone through with the pandemic and people turning to therapy and self, you know, and mental health being important, I thought it would be funny to have Cedric play a therapist, and he was offering a support group to these super recognizable actors that had never won Emmys. And it was a safe space where they could own the fact that they were mad about it. And so when I wrote that, it was like, okay, therapy is a real thing. There are these very real issues. And it's just funny that somebody like Scott Bakula is mad about anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of those things where, as a sketch, it came to life and was really cool. You know, Jason Alexander was in it. Dr. Phil was in it. Like, it turned into a very cool sketch.
Right.
And the day after the Emmys, I end up reading the USA Today review of the Emmys.
Right.
And they hated it.
Yeah.
Like, they said that, you know, it's just – they're just whiny and narcissistic and, like, they so were not on board with it.
Well,
and I'm like, that's the – that's the exact thing I'm making fun of.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
You
missed the funny. And I have a high affinity for USA Today because that was my go-to Tonight Show writing newspaper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I'm like, it was very, that experience is really interesting. And it does teach you to let things kind of roll off your back. And you've got to live and die with your instincts.
Yeah, advice I was given early on was don't read the comments.
Yes, yes.
You just can't.
And sometimes, though,
I'm guilty of it.
Yeah, in that instance, I read the comments because I was like, I want to see what the effect of your writing is and how people are interpreting it. And so, like, as much as USA Today hated that sketch, the New York Times was really favorable to a lot of the comedy stuff. And I'm like, okay, cool. Well, you got to find the happy medium that you're comfortable with. Like, that's the toughest thing about being a, you know, producer, writer for hire for these bigger jobs is you're constantly asking yourself, what was the effect? And comedy that doesn't make an effect doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like the person it's the person that does the special that's not special. You know what I mean?
Where it's just an hour.
You may laugh,
but you won't remember a thing when you walk out.
It doesn't move the meter.
You've
got to be funny enough, and your comedy has to be impactful enough to have an effect.
I joke that I would love to get canceled.
Yes.
You know, it's a career move now.
Yes.
If I could only find some group to make that angry.
Yes.
The other thing it makes me think of, and I get your opinion on this, on how comedy has changed. Al Franken, two characters that if he did today, I wonder how they would, two old SNL characters, I should say. We had It's Pat, right,
mm-hmm.
where we weren't
mm-hmm.
sure what mm-hmm. Pat was.
And the funny was...
Yeah, is Pat a guy or a woman?
What is Pat's story? And I don't want to know Pat's story.
Right, and then the therapy thing with I am good enough.
Yes,
I'm like
yes.
So today, so in regards to what you said about your therapy sketch, would they look at that today and say, well, he's making fun of therapy and people have real problems. What do you think?
A, I'm not making fun of therapy.
No, I know.
But I just need to, like, you're looking at the wrong targets if that's what you think. You know what I mean?
But that's what I'm saying. So I think if he did those, if they did those characters today, they would completely miss the comedy of the characters.
Or hopefully you find something within the rhythm of those characters that's so universally funny that you excuse those other things. Like, you only become outraged. Well, I can't even say that. I was going to say you only become outraged if it's not universally funny. But what's universally funny these days?
Right.
You know, that's the problem.
And you lead into the next thing, and I want to talk about this. I'm loving talking to you, by the way. This is very cool because we know each other. We talk, we laugh, but we don't do this kind of talk. So
sure,
I love this kind of talk.
And this kind of like this kind of talk. You know, being a comedy writer, dude, like the day we were doing the Emmys, you know, you're there early. I have on like regular gear and I have my tuxedo in the car. So I got to go back and get my tuxedo.
Which, by the way, shows that, see, the writers have their tuxedo in the car. They don't have a trailer.
Just
so you know the hierarchy to my listeners.
Yes.
Just so you know.
Yeah. Writers are like the front line. You know what I mean? Like, you are firefighters without the good pension, you know? So, you know, I have my tuxedo in the car, and it comes a point in the day where I'm going to go get my tuxedo to change, and it's, you know, almost showtime. And this is a big production, dude. So there's a woman that's working as a bartender, and she sees me, and she's like, oh, are you a bartender? And I started busting up, dude. I was like... And normally I just would be like, yeah, I'm a bartender, right? But I just felt after 3 months of working on the Emmys, I said, I'm actually the host writer. And the look on her face was...
So you're not going to make whiskey sours?
I'm going to drink them after the show. I'm not going to make them. But the look on her face was like, oh.
So you touched on, and I love that you touched on it, on about what's funny to all. And the everything's politicized now, right? Even like the vaccine, the mask, the medical thing, you know, I joked about it earlier. But it's all politicized now. So when you do this, and again, I'm asking you as a stand-up and as a writer, people always ask me, they're like, because my act is very liberal, right? And I make fun of the stupidity, you know? And I tell people, why? It's like there's a lot of stupid conservatives, you know? There is no Marjorie Taylor Greene on the left. If there was, we'd make fun of her.
Right.
But AOC is not as funny.
And how are people reacting to your act now in this moment?
Oh, you know, I always say that one of the things is when you do comedy, when you go to comedy clubs and stuff, it's generally a liberal audience, that really angry right-wing audience. They don't go to comedy shows unless they know it's one of theirs.
Right.
They're just, they don't laugh a lot. They're very angry, very angry people.
Yes.
So the question is, are you conscious of that? And how difficult is it when you have to write to be conscious of that? For, you know, your act, first question about your act, second question about your writing.
Well, I think my act has evolved based on where we are right now, where I made the conscious shift. For the year and a half prior to the pandemic, I was touring with Sean Wayans. And we were just doing two-person shows. I would go up cold and do a half hour and then bring him up, and then he would do the rest of the time. And so I often didn't advertise those shows. I would just show up and be a dude in a comedy club doing his stuff.
Yeah.
And going up cold...
And to the audience, that means there's nobody ahead of him.
Yeah, there's nobody ahead of you. Sometimes there's no music. They butcher your first name, probably butcher your credits, and you go on stage to a cold audience. But I found, even though I was a Tonight Show writer, and I grew up in Northern California, and my father was a Muslim, and my mom was Catholic, before I got to any of that stuff, I had to connect in a more universal way. So I found I did a lot less comedic writing about politically charged events unless I had a joke or a point of view that was so undeniably funny. I was like, let me work on other facets of who I am and what my life experience is as a means of connecting with these audiences on the road.
Right.
So it changed. It did change. And rather than call out biases, my approach was, I'm going to be political by not being political right now.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, and then some things you feel like you have to talk about. Like, you know, I mean, I got assaulted before,
right?
You know, before everything got shut down. And that experience is one that, you know, has changed me. And I feel like you have to talk about those experiences, especially for everyone that tries to say.
Can you talk about that now, even in a broad term, to so that the audience knows
what hard you're talking about? It's hard to make it funny.
I'm not asking you to make it funny, just in broad terms, just so the audience knows that we as comics, our real life influences what we create.
Yes. And that's always been the tone of my stand-up, though.
Right.
So it does fall in line with what I try to do on stage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I approach it from, this is a real moment, and let's have an experience where, you know, you come away being like, that guy's funny, and he gave me a perspective maybe that I'm not thinking about or ever thought about.
Well, it's a racial experience, right? Like, I talk about it.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
And you know, I talk about it like being a big black guy, right? Like, you and me are kind of opposite ends of the physical spectrum. And, you know, so when people talk about the police and the this and that, I'm like, no, I live that. Like, I've been the threat. And I tell everybody, I just aged out.
Yes.
Like, I'm just old enough now that now if I have a BMW, they're like, yeah, he's old enough.
Yeah, right, you know? Right. Good for Lou Rawls. He got a BMW. I'm a wiry black guy. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I fit a lot of stereotypic portrayals of what a threat is.
Right.
But I'm also a full-grown adult with two kids.
Yeah.
Like, one that, you know, is 24 and a 16-year-old.
Right.
So I am a dad, you know, and that's how I identify myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, that instance when I was assaulted, you know, like, there were two squad cars in my garage, and I was under a police helicopter.
Right.
And I was the threat when I was the victim.
The victim, yeah. And people, they don't understand how real that is. You know?
I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, right now, you have Crazy Legs under a police helicopter, like he's a threat, and he's in his garage,
right,
in his neighborhood,
and he's
lived for 5 years.
I had an experience. It was this debate, conservative comics versus liberal comics. It wasn't.
That doesn't sound fun at all, by the way.
It wasn't done well. It was something that could have been.
That sounds like something where you end up finishing that, you shake hands, you get your check.
Yeah.
You know, you get your check, then you shake hands, and then you walk away like, I probably shouldn't have did that.
It could have been good, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't moderated well.
Yeah.
But one of the things, and the guy came up to me, this comic, white conservative, right-wing guy, came up to me after because I said, man, you don't know what it's like to have a cop point a gun at you. Like, you have no idea.
Yes,
like, I know what that's like.
Yes.
And he actually came to me and he said, you know, man, I did have to think about that when you said it.
Yeah.
Because it never enters their mind.
No.
And in that moment, you're not a comedian. You're not a guy on TV. You're not anything but a black man who is a threat. And your life could end in that moment.
Dude, the evening I got assaulted, I was leaving my garage. A guy walks up to me, and I can tell by the look in his eyes something bad is about to happen.
Yeah.
And he says, you stole my phone, and I traced it to your garage.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I share a garage. Second of all, I've done enough where I can afford my own phone. I don't have to steal other people's phones.
Right.
So the guy starts attacking me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in an alley in Sherman Oaks, and I know because of where I'm at, I can't fight back.
Yeah.
And to be engaged in a fight where you can't fight back says everything.
Right.
So, long story short, I'm under a police helicopter. Squad cars pull up. This guy goes back to his apartment like nothing happened.
Yeah.
And I'm left to clean up.
Because in his world, it didn't.
Nothing did happen. Like, I'm left to clean up the damages. And I'm a comedian. And I'm in a life or death situation. So I've gone from averting one kind of attack to now I've got to make sure the cops don't overreact
right.
and fire on me in my own garage, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So just the mental processing of that as your reality, like in that moment I'm thinking, oh, I can't say, oh, I was on the Jamie Foxx show or I played, you know, Crazy Legs and Don't Be a Menace. Mm-hmm. Like none of that shit matters.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter at all. You know what I mean? Like you are in a situation where you are perceived as a threat and nothing that you've done, the person that you are, how you live your life, where you spend your priorities, how you try and move, and none of that matters. It's perception of if you're a threat or not.
Yeah, it's a real moment.
It's a real moment.
It's a real moment. And this is where, again, where people think that, you know, once you've been on TV, you've made it.
Yes.
And this and that. It's like, nah, life still happens. Life still happens. You know, and the other thing, I want to talk about this, and then we're going to wrap it up with sports because we love sports.
Yeah,
No, because I'm going to talk about some crazy in sports, which is just funny to me. But I will tell you, when you see another person's perspective, and I think this is something we have lost in on a societal level, seeing another person's perspective. I will never forget reading a tweet about this woman wrote. It was, you know, talking about women being attacked and women's safety and this and that. She said, men don't understand that whenever I go somewhere, I have to think about where to park because it may be dark when I leave. And men never have that thought. And it hit me like a ton of bricks because I was like, she's right. I've never in my life had that thought. Not once have I said, oh, I can't park here because it's going to be dark and it's going to be dangerous for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me, it just kind of opened my eyes to, oh, so these are the issues, like we're talking about real life. That's like real life that women deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a real threat that
sure.
they deal with. Like,
sure.
I can't park here because, oh, it's fine now.
Yeah.
But the sun goes down. Now somebody could be waiting for me or
sure.
following me or whatever. And what you talked about is real.
Yes.
And this is why I think comedians, we will always talk about issues and this and that. Forget about your politics and your whose feelings we're going to hurt. We talk about it because it's real.
And I think it's part of your responsibility if you've chose this path.
Right.
Like there's a, you know, I started doing this when I was 19. And I do remember when you were a doorman. And it was funny because at that time, you know, like I you know, the great thing about stand-up is if you're in this for the long term, you know, cream rises and it all evens out.
Mm-hmm.
But at that phase, I probably was getting more spots or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like when we bonded at that time, I think you were like, as the big dude, you know, they like the little skinny dude, you know what I mean? But I liked that because I knew your heart was in it in the right place, and you were also talking about your perspective from an authentic place.
Right.
Like I remember we did that show at Dublin's years ago,
yeah.
and you went on after me, and I was doing my jokes or whatever, and you did this really funny bit that you had just riffed about. You said, like it was hilarious because you said, you can tell Sully's never been to jail. And the audience busted up because it was the truth.
Yeah.
Like, my comedy was, this is comedy from a black guy that's never been to jail, right? And it was such a succinct observation that was then backed up with your perspective
yeah.
that I was like, oh, this dude's a real one forever. You know what I mean? Like, you called it out. Like, and it was just so. Like, I still haven't been to jail.
Yeah, well, you know, game respects game, right? Game
exactly.
Respects game.
Exactly.
So now I'm gonna move, and just because this is what's going on, and I don't know if it even relates to what we're talking about, but I wanted to talk to you about this. So athletes, I'm talking about the vaccinations and the things, you know, what's going on. Okay, athletes now are much more in the public eye than when we were coming up because social media tells me everything about them. In other words,
sure.
Back in the day, you know, I have no idea what Dr. J's political beliefs were. You know what I mean? I don't know where Daryl Dawkins may have stood on the vaccination controversy, right? Because we didn't know. Nobody knew. We didn't follow him 24/7.
I loved Pete Rose. For Pete Rose.
Right.
Like, I didn't care what Pete Rose thought about issues.
And
if I did, I still would probably love Pete Rose.
Well, now, if Pete Rose happened now, they'd be like, wait, gambling?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Wait, you're not beating your wife?
Yes.
You're not on
yes.
drugs? You haven't
yes.
raped anybody? Gambling? Man, get the hell out of here
yes.
and go play baseball.
Yes.
Gambling.
Yes.
We bet on you.
Yes. Yes.
They have gambling commercials
yes.
on baseball games
yes.
now, right?
Yes.
Which is they're like, why is Pete Rose not in the Hall of Fame? When they have gambling commercials.
He was ahead of the curve.
But now we do have it, okay, and I'm going to give you my take on these three, and then I want your take on these three.
Okay.
Kyrie Irving.
Okay.
I respect his statement on Facebook Live when he talked about, I'm not making a political statement, I'm doing this for me. I have chosen to not get vaccinated. I don't want to end my NBA career, but I respect him because he realizes this could be the end of your career.
Sure.
But he's like sticking to it. Now, what goes on in Kyrie Irving's head? I don't know. To me, Kyrie Irving is like Dennis Rodman, but not funny.
Yes. 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 Yes.
Then,
yeah.
Then we had Andrew Wiggins.
Yes.
Okay. Plays for the Golden State Warriors. To the listeners, that's California team. They're in San Francisco. California has a mandate for vaccination in arenas, so he could not play in his home games. And he said, it's my religion and this and that. And then they said, you're not getting paid. He got vaccinated the next day. To anyone curious, Jesus cost $9 million a
right.
season.
And he was pretty blunt about it. He said, look, I want to be able to do my chosen profession.
Right.
And this is the only way to do it, so that's why I did it.
Okay, and then finally, and this guy I'm just reading about, and he is comical. I don't know if you're familiar. Evander Kane, he's a hockey player for the San Jose Sharks.
I don't know. I know the Sharks well because I went to San Jose
Kane,
State for 2 years.
Evander Kane actually tried to get by with a fake vaccination card.
Fantastic.
He's an NHL player. Now,
yes.
The NHL famously... Four players not vaccinated. They got the whole league on.
Yes.
He had a fake card. It's going to cost him $1.6 million of this season's salary. And with some other things that he's done, like he has been a problem since he's been in the league.
Yes.
And he's a black hockey player.
Uh-huh.
If you're black and in the NHL, there's already a spotlight on you because while there are more black hockey players, it's still not common.
Yes, it's still special.
I'm sure all, you know, and this is something, listen to my white listeners, this is something black people know. You do something like this, it reflects on all of us, right? I'm sure every black player in the NHL is like, I'm going to whip his ass.
Yes.
But
if, yes.
Don't be stupid.
And how many
card?
Yeah, how many black players are there in the NHL?
I'll have to look it up. Well,
yeah,
I'll look up the exact number.
I want to know.
But there's more. It's not like there's more than two. Like there was a time when they were, oh, there's only two of you.
Yeah.
And who was it? Patrick Waugh? Was he
yes.
the one who they denied being black?
Yes.
Oh, he's
yes.
French Canadian.
Yeah, he's
you
not
know, really?
Black. He's,
really? That fro looks
yeah.
kind of.
He's Creole-ish. He's Cape Verdean.
So what do you think of it? What's your take? This is,
well,
I'm talking.
The Kyrie thing is it's problematic to me for a number of reasons. First of all, I feel like the comparisons to Muhammad Ali are just insane. We're talking about a completely different situation. If you are ready to walk away from the game because of your beliefs. Okay, I think you'll have a totally different view about this in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm somebody that tries to look to stay present, but also have some sort of long-range vision about what you're doing in this moment. You know,
do you think this will end his career?
I don't know, because I don't know if he's going to have a change of heart, if someone's going to convince him that, when I got vaccinated, I was like, okay, if I want to continue to do the things that I enjoy doing and also give myself an added sort of, to me, the vaccine is like a bulletproof vest. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's like, if you could get a free bulletproof vest, why wouldn't you?
Right. And to me, it wasn't even that big debate. It was like, oh, you have a vaccine against the deadly virus. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and take it.
Yes, yes. Oh, I already work in comedy clubs where I don't know anyone's backstory that
right.
I'm spending lots of time talking about my stuff with. I'm going to get the vaccine.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, it's weird because I really enjoy Kyrie's talents. If you're going to make this big deal to create a team with your fellow players, that has to mean something. And not getting the vaccination is kind of – you're kind of walking away on what your bigger life objectives are.
Well, I like how you touched on that because there is a responsibility as a team sport.
Yes.
You have – no matter how great you are, you still have a responsibility to your teammates. Forget about the bigger picture in society.
Yes.
You know, now your team doesn't know who's the starting five going to be on any given day.
And if they can count on you and if you're all in it for the same reasons. And, you know, we follow championships. You know, we're big sports fans. But that sense of team and that sense of shared purpose – seems to anchor what these drives and missions are, regardless of what you're being paid and your talents. You know,
and tell me if you agree with this or not, but this is something we have lost as a society.
Absolutely.
The shared experience and the responsibility to others.
Yes, absolutely. And that's gone away in a way that's really troubling.
Yeah.
And it's something that has always been important to me because stand-up is – it really is like a – like no man's land. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like you do have to have a sort of sense of community and feel like, okay, if nothing else, I care about jokes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so somebody else that's been doing it for as long as I have, they obviously care about it too. So honor that community that
the
you're
art.
A part of.
And
honor
the art.
The art. Yes. Yes.
You know. So what do you think about Wiggins?
I feel like Wiggins, you know, he was honest about his decision. He's like, I don't agree with this. It goes against what my belief system is, but I also want to get paid. And I'm a professional player, and I'm playing with Steph Curry. And you know what I mean? Like, I felt like he was like, okay.
See, this is the way, and again, to me, I don't have a joke about Kyrie.
Yes.
But definitely Wiggins, because your beliefs folded so quick in the light of –
What is
of,
he, 22
you know,
at the most?
No, Wiggins been around for a few years, you know.
Okay.
See, here's the thing, Sully. We're so old that everyone's 22
now.
Yeah,
that's very true. That's very true. My daughter's 24, and everyone is 22 to me.
No, Wiggins is probably in his mid to late 20s. Now, on the on the NHL, okay, 97% of the NHL is white. The other 3% is made up of different ethnicities. Of the different ethnicities, 26 players are black.
That's a lot. That's more than I thought.
I was surprised too.
I thought you were going to say 8.
No.
Yeah, but it's in the double digits.
No, I have a friend.
Good job, hockey.
No, I have a friend. I shout him out whenever I can. His name's Ryan Reeves.
Yeah.
Great hockey player. I met him doing a sports thing in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
He played for St. Louis. He played for Vegas. Now he's playing for the Rangers. But when I met him, the whole thing was I joked about black hockey players. And he came up to me and he's like, I'm a black hockey player. And I was like, identify yourself, you know.
Yes.
But there's quite a few. The funny thing and the thing I love about Revo was when I saw his highlight, like he's the enforcer, you know,
yes,
how hockey
people. Yes, yes.
So when I saw him knocking the hell out of people, I was like, I am so glad he laughed at my joke. This guy could kill me.
Right.
So you're a black hockey player, and you don't just. It'd be one thing if you said I'm not getting vaccinated, but come on, a fake vaccine card soon?
Right. Come on. It's very Bush League. It's very. I'm really trying to get to Coachella.
What? It cost you $1.6 million.
Yes. Yeah, that's idiotic.
What's the thought process?
That's idiotic. That's idiotic. As someone who works for whatever the Writers Guild scale is, I can't even comprehend it. I can't comprehend it. And as a sneaker collector, that's where I'm mad at Kyrie. If you want to find an angle.
Well, hey.
Because here's the thing.
But if you have some of his, could they not go up in value if he never plays another game?
Yeah, but it depends on what public opinion feels. If you start to hate him for never playing, then they plummet in value. So, I actually saw a pair of Kyries the other day that I was like, want to, can't.
You know, and this is another aspect. And we got to wrap this up because I don't want to keep you all afternoon. And the listeners, I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. But real quick, talk about your sneaker collecting because I got a few pair of sneakers.
Oh, and I have way too
I
many
bumped
sneakers.
Into you. And yeah. then we bumped into this topic and I was like, whoa, this is a sneakerhead.
I'm a real sneakerhead. I started collecting sneakers right after college, like right around when I started doing stand-up. And I would be on the road, and instead of going to strip clubs and finding ways to lose that little bit of money that I was making, I would go to Nike outlets because I knew what the collectible stuff was. I would use that time, find stuff, buy it, and take it back with me, and that way turn a meager week at a at a comedy club in a mall into a little better week. So that was like part of my – it was very ingrained to my stand-up experience. And somewhere along the way, I think I've just gone overboard because now my apartment looks like – a dude that used to be a manager at a Foot Locker that broke up with his girl and she left because of the sneakers.
So we're going to wrap up with this because people have asked me, and I'm asking a true expert.
Okay.
How do you decide which pair to wear?
It's completely random. I've got about 7 or 8 pairs in my weekly rotation that are like my go-tos, you know, my Smart and Final sneakers and my comedy sneakers and my, you know, going to the gym with my son sneakers. And my son, by the way, is the biggest beneficiary
of
my collection.
Oh, yeah, next generation. Yeah,
he's my size now. And, you know, like I've been selling stuff and if not selling stuff, like I'm kicking him down with stuff, and so it really is like I feel like he's Batman, and you know, I'm his ward,
right?
You know what I mean? So he's the real beneficiary of this, but I definitely have 8 pairs in rotation. I have some that are so good they're in a closet that I occasionally look at that I go, should I wear these? But it has to be a special occasion.
Did you contemplate sneakers for the Emmys?
No. No, I didn't.
Really?
No.
Because a lot of people are wearing sneakers with suits and tuxedos.
I went full on tuxedo with the nice shoes.
Yeah.
I did rock a dope pair the day before just to keep it real. Just to be like, all right, I didn't all the way sell
And
out.
Is that a test for other sneakerheads who, when they notice what you're wearing, they're like, whoa.
Oh, yeah.
This is,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's levels to the flex. Like sometimes I'll do a show. Like when I do spots at the, you know, at the Improv or whatever, if occasionally I'll ramp it up just to see who knows, you know what I mean? Like I have a couple pairs that are really up there now, and I'll just break them out just to see who knows. So and then sometimes I do it just to be funny. Like I have worn original Air Jordan 85s to open mics.
Yeah.
just to be like, yeah, I'm
that's
not,
flexing though.
That's super flexing.
Because the open mic, like his Jordans aren't even Jordans.
No, they're mids.
They're his Jordans.
Yeah, yeah. No, sometimes you got to do that, though. Sometimes you got to let them know.
So let me, just so you know, kid, these shoes cost what you dream of making.
Yes,
you
yes,
dream of, yes. of earning what I paid for these.
Yes. Yes.
I love that. So to my audience, the fantastic Sully McCullough, and tell them where to find you and where to follow you, Sully.
You can find me on social media under my name, Sully McCullough, SullyMcCullough, and that's on all social media platforms. We didn't even get a chance to talk Gary Shandling at all, so we'll have
that's
to do
right.
that next
we gotta,
time.
That's right. We got to talk Gary Shandling
yes.
and basketball. No, but what I wanted to talk about, I want to tell my audience, because they all know that I'm a gearhead.
Yes.
So I want to tell them how deep he is on sneakers. He had one of the most beautiful classic 911s, people. That what year was it? 70?
It was a 72 911 T with S options, silver, hard top. I bought it. I was the third owner. Second owner had it since 75.
Yeah.
A blue plate car. It was beautiful.
Magnificent car. Unfortunately, yes. Car got stolen.
In Sherman Oaks.
And he gave up Porsches, but stayed with his sneakers.
Right.
I just want to tell you, that's how deep the sneaker thing goes with this man.
Yes. And you never actually give up Porsches. I'm just taking a temporary hiatus.
Sully, thank you so much. Yeah, we got to talk about Shandling and those bass. No, we're going to. All right, this is the PS really quick.
Okay.
How come I never got invited to the game? It was you, Shandling, Kevin Neal, and this and that. You knew me.
I knew I played.
My knees still worked.
Yeah.
How come I never got a call?
You know what? That's totally my bad. I think I probably got caught up in being one of the few black people in that game, and power corrupts.
You see how we do each other? You could have been my guard. I'd have been a big man.
Exactly.
We wasn't playing the same position.
That's very true.
You see
true.
How we do?
That's very
right.
true.
I'm going to step on his sneakers. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to catch him. I'm going to catch him in his originals.
Yeah.
And I'm going to step on him with my big ass foot.
Yep.
Sully, thank you so much, bro.
Yeah, dude, this is fun. Yeah. We didn't even talk Clippers. We could talk Clippers.
We will. We yeah. definitely will. It's going to be a season. Who's paying attention? This is Alonzo Bowden with Sully McCullough. Thanks for listening. This weekend, I am going to be at Flappers Comedy Club in Burbank, the 22nd and 23rd. October 30th, I'm at JR's Comedy in Valencia. And the first weekend of November, I will be happily back in Tampa at Side Splitters, because I love Tampa and I'm brave enough to go to Florida.
Hear, hear.
Thank you. We out.